Hugh Howard.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! Then we'll figure out what to do about the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. But first, get up out of your chairs, open the window, stick your head out and yell, and say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Something that this book has helped me to start to identify is that there's a lot of, again, clumping emotions together into one thing, trying to get better at like differentiating what I'm actually feeling.
This is a good companion, I think, to the six pillars and that first pillar. Make the commitment to occupy or to go into that awareness. Then you have to start noticing those things, I think. If you are also committed to putting labels to things so they can be useful or at least not harmful, the acceptance of anger, like we get hurt in a situation, whether we're in a car, we're playing sports or whatever, when we become stiff and rigid and unaccepting of what's about to happen to us. So emotionally, when it's like, oh God, anger, whether you're, you know, a parent dealing with it with a child or experiencing it yourself, just having that, we could use that phrase, emotional agility, to roll with it, facilitate it, right? You said facilitate it, whether it's in yourself or in your child.
Reinforcing it, and maybe, like, I think I've been getting better at, I think naming the emotion does help you create that space and maybe not getting swept up in it. I'm finding myself more often being able to say, like I said it to the lady at the doctor's office, I'm like, I'm feeling really frustrated right now. and I say that to my son, and usually that seems to help kind of diffuse, or maybe that brings me back into more presence or being grounded and not being swept up.
Yeah, and when somebody doesn't know how you feel, when you're dealing with a person and they don't know how you feel, they're your opponent. And if they do know how you feel, they're more like a teammate. If they don't know how you feel, it's like, not only do I have to deal with this person while I feel like this, I also have to hide how I feel, right? Which is just a producer of resentment towards whoever you have to deal with. Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is June 15th. So what you're going to hear is the book club that we did, a while back. I think this was June 5th. I'm sorry about my absence, but last week we ran the pilot summit, Nathan Fraser and I, of Mindset and Mastery. And I would say that despite a smaller turnout than we could have accommodated, it went very, very well. In fact, a friend of mine, a dear friend, a ray of sunshine of a friend of mine who attended, I don't think he was there for the live portion, but he enrolled, so he was listening to the recording. He just made it through day one, just called me right before I started recording to tell me how meaningful the first day was. And I said, wait till you get to the second day, unnamed friend. So it's interesting, the intersection of like reading this book for our University book club. University is our private community. It's your social media replacement when you decide that you are ready actually don't even look into that anymore now. I am, as we try to bring that up to its maximum number of participants, which I think is 200, I'm going to set up a monthly payment option, and that gets you access to a very varied and robust Discord. It gets you access to all of our clubs, our Sunday discussion groups, which are very much open forum, even though this last Sunday, Nathan and I prioritized people who attended Mindset and Mastery, and we answered some follow-up questions and took some advice about how we can improve it. And this was, you know, the takeaway was, man, that was great. I felt so energized once it concluded, I immediately want to do it again. So we're planning another one for the summer, hopefully. Oh, gosh, hopefully by the end of July. But I will keep you posted about that. So, yes, the interesting intersection between preparing for Mindset and Mastery and reading this book and just the overlap of ideas. And this book, even though it wasn't a ton of new information, it was an interesting reframing of a lot of things, kind of an integration of a lot of things that I already knew and had even talked about on the show, but it inspired Discomfort Week, releasing those episodes of The Discomfort Zone. There was one more that I chose not to release, not quite yet, but what is talked about in that show will be talked about on this podcast very soon. Brett, what are you talking about? Never mind. So the full title of this book you're about to hear a group discussion on is The Upside of Your Dark Side, Why Being Your Whole Self, Not Just Your Good Self, Drives Success and Fulfillment by Todd B. Kashdan and Robert Biswas Diener. And I'm just going to read you an excerpt from the introduction, The Promise of Wholeness. And I'm just going to tell you ahead of time here, the authors use like elite special forces military training as an example. If we could all just agree that what some of these people have to do requires a certain amount of emotional fortitude, that would be helpful. It's not my favorite example, but it sets the tone for the book pretty well. And perhaps we could be hopeful that someday the emotional fortitude described in what I'm about to read can be used for something other than expanding and maintaining the American empire. So the point is, you're just going to have to tolerate a few unchecked premises in what I'm about to read. Perhaps the most difficult test commonly used for recruiting elite special forces soldiers has nothing to do with marksmanship or proficiency in hand-to-hand combat. It's a simple jog down a remote road. Young men are instructed to don full gear and report to the starting point early in the morning, often sleep-deprived and hungry. What makes this particular run unusually challenging is that none of the candidates are told the length of the course. Is it 300 yards, 3 miles, 30 miles? The stakes are high as the recruits begin their jog into the unknown. Some sprint forward in hopes of being the first if the run is short. Others pace themselves, carefully conserving energy in the thought that the run could turn out to be a marathon. Some keep to themselves, trusting in their resolve and determination. Others jog together as a group, shouting words of encouragement. Running with 60-pound packs is tiring, but the physical exertion is less demanding than the mental strain. The pressure of not knowing the distance to the finish line pushes many to the breaking point. Ambiguous tasks are a good place to observe how personality traits bubble to the surface. Although few of us are elite soldiers, we've all experienced the kind of psychological distress that these trainees encounter on their training run. Managing unclear expectations, struggling with self-motivation, and balancing the use of social support with private reflection. These issues are endemic not only to the workplace, but also to relationships, health, and every aspect of life in which we seek to thrive and succeed. Not surprisingly, the leading predictor of success in elite military training programs is the same quality that distinguishes those best equipped to resolve marital conflict, to achieve favorable deal terms in business negotiations, and to bestow the gifts of good parenting on their children, the ability to tolerate psychological discomfort. This is what psychologists refer to as distress tolerance, a quality found in people who can handle the emotional equivalent of camping, no shampoo, flush toilets, or walls to keep out creepy crawlers, who don't shy away from anger, guilt, or boredom just because they feel bad. Instead, they withstand the discomfort of those feelings and, when appropriate, even draw from this darker palette of emotions. You might be asking, why would I want to do that? Pain hurts. I'd rather be happy. If this question occurs to you, we're nodding our heads in full agreement. We want you to be happy too. Distress tolerance is important not just because it makes you a better camper or soldier, but also because it allows you to become stronger, wiser, mentally agile, and most important, happier in a more resilient and therefore durable way. After more than a decade of working with patients, clients, students, small companies, and organizations as large as the military and Fortune 100, we, the authors, are putting forward a new way to pursue what's desirable in life. It's not happiness exactly, although it does have the side effect of making us happier. We call this state wholeness. So the focus of our book club is personal development books. This was my favorite of all the ones we've read so far. We have a lively group discussion featuring several participants. I want to thank Carrie for organizing the book club. Other voices include Bobby, Nikki, Gretchen, Gabriella, myself. And this is the third time that one of these book club discussions has become a podcast. So I really appreciate everybody's willingness to be heard by a large group of people discussing sometimes personal matters. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this. I'm really enjoying doing these listener participant created shows. And I hope you are too. I welcome your feedback. Just a heads up, next month we'll be doing a book called Influence by Robert Cialdini. And here is our group discussion of the upside of your dark side.
There will always be experts, especially in psychology, who argue that one particular way of being happy, hearty, optimistic is a cure-all. In this book, we take a different approach. Instead of suggesting that one state is best, we suggest that they all are. We believe, and new research supports, the idea that every emotion is useful, even the ones we think of as negative, including the painful ones. Anger is a good example. Research shows that only rarely does anger turn into the kind of overwhelming rage that leads to violence. Instead, it tends to bubble up when you perceive an encroachment on your rights as a person. Anger stirs you to defend yourself and those you care about, and to maintain healthy boundaries. Similarly, embarrassment is sometimes an early warning sign of humiliation. More often, it's a signal that we've made a small mistake and that a small correction is required. Even guilt is not as awful as you might guess. It's a signal that you're violating your own moral code and therefore need to adjust either your actions or your code. All psychological states have some adaptive advantage. Rather than steering you toward a single feeling state, then, we urge you to consider the usefulness of many, especially the ones we turn away from, and to develop the ability to navigate every one. For some people, seeing the bright side of life is an uphill battle. For others, feeling sad is an unusual event. We don't suggest an extra helping of happiness or a dash of negativity. We suggest both. It is by appropriately flipping back and forth between these two states that you can achieve a balanced, stabilizing sense of wholeness. Simply put, people who are able to use the whole range of their natural psychological gifts, those folks who are comfortable with being both positive and negative, and can therefore draw from the full range of human emotions, are the healthiest and often the most successful. Wholeness does not come easily, however. We get comfortable with pursuing a certain set of emotions. They make us feel good. Riding high in the moment is hard to pass up. Think of a perfect kiss when your lips meld into the moistness of your partner's, or of hearing the cheers of fellow employees when your name is announced for having won an award. Other emotions, like anger and guilt, are so painful that we avoid or suppress them. It turns out that the uncertainty, frustration, and occasional dash of guilt that stem from broken hearts, missed basketball shots at the buzzer, and botched interviews are the seeds of growth in knowledge and maturity. These often unwanted, negative experiences end up shaping some of the most memorable and inspiring experiences of our lives. By learning to embrace and use negative emotions as well as positive ones, we position ourselves for success. Life gave me lemonade and I can't imagine why. Born on a sunny day beneath the tangerine sky. I live life without pretending. I'm a sucker for happy endings. Thanks for the lemonade. Thanks for the lemonade. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thanks for the lemonade. Thanks for the lemonade.
All right. Got a lot of notes. notes.
I was thinking that this morning, this book, like the further you get into the book, the better it gets, like the more relevant it is, it became to my life.
That's a shame because I didn't get to the last two chapters.
Okay.
So I loved it. I'm definitely going to finish it.
Yeah.
But I look forward to hearing your insights. Don't worry about spoiling anything for me.
So does anybody want to go first?
Okay. So I'm like Brad, I only got through chapter 6. The stuff that I liked, like the way it started out, it just kind of like I was, I got into jiu-jitsu because of Jocko. I was a big Jocko podcast listener back in the day. And if you ever study David Goggins, these are guys that are like, they kind of like turn into the suffering. And this was kind of like, that's the way the book kind of like opens up about how like being happiness just leaves you empty. So you kind of got to, do more at it. Like, and as you said, as it kept going on, I was thinking that there was the thing that really kind of blew my mind was what you want and what you like come from two separate parts of your brain. So, I mean, that kind of like, I always knew that just because you want something doesn't mean you're going to like it when you get it. But the fact that it's two completely different regions of the brain just kind of like was like, oh my God, I don't really have to listen to what I want anymore, And so that was kind of like this crazy insight from that. That was really the big, like, mind blown one that I got from that. So from the book.
Yeah.
Big My Dinner with Andre tie in too for the people who were in that movie club, like his whole blanket speech, or what was it? Electric blanket speech.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically how the book opens.
Another synchronous thing that I saw was I started listening to one of the recent Bridget Fetasy podcasts where she's interviewing Glenn Greenwald. And he, I haven't listened to the whole thing yet, but he talks about a couple of things that I felt like related. So for example, he was talking about Julian Assange and he said something to the effect of, so Julian Assange is a very kind of polarizing personality. And he said, the thing is, if a person who would make an organization that's specific purpose is to uncover stuff that's going on and evils and whatever has to be an asshole. Like a nice person would never do that. And I just thought that was pretty profound. And then he was also talking about the difference between how the gay, like gay movement and like how gay people kind of became accepted in society. And then kind of the law changed based on that. The way the trans movement is happening is the opposite way. They're trying to force you to become accepting. And that it just doesn't work that way, that you kind of have to, like he was saying, he was like, when I was a young gay man back in the 90s, if someone said I'm against gay marriage, that would be exciting for me because that would be a reason for me to interact with that person and talk about the reasons why and maybe start to change some minds. And that no longer happens. So I thought those two things were really interesting. I'm excited to listen to the rest of the conversation, but I thought they were related to this book a lot.
Yeah. So you're basically doing no favors for a group of people by threatening.
Yeah. Kind of... And he mentioned some guy and I can't remember Buck, someone who is a trans man, maybe, I'm not sure. But he is literally preaching this. Like, I want trans people to be successful, but the problem is that you're doing it wrong. And so he's kind of like ahead of that movement of trying to like explain to people why they're doing it wrong and what tactics would work better.
Buck Angel's the guy.
Yes. Yes, that is correct. Thank you.
We just actually watched the Jordan Peterson documentary on Amazon. So I had to relive all of that agitation from 4 years ago. And I remember when those debates were happening on Canadian television and the people who claimed to be, I mean, what's new? This is par for the course with social justice, but the people who claimed to be advocating for the trans community were actually the people I thought doing the most damage when Jordan Peterson was actually telling them what they needed to hear and didn't play that way. So, but just the fragility, if I dare, of a lot of those people because of that stuff. That's actually a really good insight. And I never really thought about it quite that way before.
It's funny too, like with the whole happiness and like we were talking about, like the softness with the electric blanket. Like it's like trees that aren't, that don't grow up outside. They don't get like wind blown into them, so they don't build up the like muscle to defend themselves against wind. Like when they're like greenhouse trees and they get put outside after like a certain size, they're just like too weak. It's funny how like there's actually people doing, you know, science on that, you know, on that end. Tim Ferriss talks about that too, where like he'll say like once a month or something, he'll just sleep on the floor, you know, he's like a hardwood floor, and he'll, so that way he'll, you know, doesn't get too accustomed to, you know, the accoutrements of, you know, of being wealthy. And because you just keep on like just focusing on pleasure, then you lose the range. They were talking about the Asian culture in the book. I just put this together is, so in the Asian culture, they have you eat a lot of stuff that's bitter that we don't have in the United States, right? And they talk about you know, developing your bitters. And when you do that, a lot of the foods in America is just too sweet. But then also like the other food you enjoy more because you can actually, it has a little more texture to it, a little more contrast. And you can enjoy like just like a little bit of sugar. I can't really do sweet tea because down here, because it's just like way too sweet, you know, just like I'll do unsweet tea and it's got a, you know, it's a little bitter to it. And then like one Hershey Kiss can this is amazing, amazing thing, as opposed to just like eating a whole bag of M&M's, or, you know what I'm saying? Like when people eat like the whole thing of ice cream. But whereas if you like set yourself up with something that's a little more bitter, then it allows you to enjoy, you know, the taste on that. And he talked about that with his studies. I'm like, if you're like focused on happy, you tend to like, your highs are much higher, but your lows are also much lower. Whereas like the Asian cultures, they don't tend to be, they have a very, like a buyer beware, like a very, they're very suspicious of happy feelings. Like they're just waiting for the other shoe to drop, or, you know, anything like that. And I thought that was funny. So.
Yeah. I mean, I really, what I took away, I forget if that was chapter 2 or 3, but just a kind of richness of life. And I think food is actually a really good analogy, because even like in healthy eating, finger quotes, there's all of this like hyper palatable, hyper palatable food, as I hold up a Quest cookie. It's like Americans demand that every single bite needs to be like an explosion of pleasure. And then if you're just eating something, I remember when I made some changes in my diet and had to like be restrictive a couple of days a week and just eat more like bland, low fat kinds of foods, it was like, oh my God, everything just tastes like mush. And the more I did it, the more like the flavors of things like green peppers came back to me. So I think that, you know, like food's an easy example to maybe get some buy-in if somebody's skeptical about this. But the word is, you know, desensitization. And that's what I think so much depression is about, is that I'm not going to that place to feel that thing. And just over time, the range of emotion limits where it's feel nothing. So
that is this place where this book really like kind of came together for me. And it was actually in chapter 7, which I know you guys haven't gotten to, but basically in chapter 7, he kind of like wraps everything up and then and gives some like other, not necessarily tools, but like some insights into ways you might be able to combat some of these issues. And one of the things that he started talking about was how we tend to clump together experiences, because he gave an example. Okay. So he's talking about emotions, right? And being able to distinguish between emotions. And he says people that can be in an emotional state and tell you exactly what's happening are far better at dealing with their emotional state than people who kind of clump emotions together. Like, so the example that he was giving was about 9/11. And there were two quotes. Basically, there was one guy who said, after 9/11, when I saw what was happening on 9/11, the first feeling I had was fear. And then I quickly turned that into anger, because you can't do anything with fear. And then they talked to another person who said, I was overrun with emotions. I felt fear, anger. I was nervous, anxious. I just felt really bad. And I just had a lot of emotions. And so his point is that the first person is the person that can deal with their emotions much more, because they haven't clumped it all together into a bunch of mess.
Well, you can deal with anything better that you can name.
Yes.
Right.
And that like, spoke to me so much because that is exactly what I do. Like I had a situation this week at work where I was put into a situation where I was asked how I feel about a certain relationship that I have with a coworker. Like I couldn't say words. Like I was like, and then it just came out and it's just kind of like rambly mess. And that's when, reading this book, because I finished this chapter this morning and I was just like, oh my God, that's exactly what it is. That not knowing what's happening in my brain fogs it up and makes me unable to like actually do something with the emotion, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, it's about opening that space, right? If you think that it's common practice, I mean, I don't know if this is like how a majority of people function, but it's common and accepted practice to have a dichotomy of comfortable versus bad, like a kind of vague comfort versus I feel bad and need to change that immediately.
Yeah.
And I mean, sure, people might know words like fear, anxiety, jealousy, like whatever the negative emotion is, but it's like, it's not like, all right, well, let's open this space and experience that thing. It's like, I feel bad. Let's change it.
Well, I also liked how they were talking about before too, about how just like when you're having like that difficult conversation with somebody, like acknowledging like this, I'm frustrated or, you know, I'm disappointed or, you know, whatever.
Like the right way to be angry, I think he called it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he talked about it like with Pat Riley's story or then like the one guy that was the coach and, you know, he had their star player was like goofing off. You know, I was like, I don't like having these conversations. I don't like this. And it's kind of funny how like, because I've had people, you know, say those things to me like that. And like, do you think this is fun for me to do like this? But then it's kind of like, well, no, I don't, you know. So the one thing we talk about, like the usefulness of, you know, of anger. I was on the water with my brother and our wives. And I get seasick when it gets like really, really motionless. And we stopped to take a picture, right? And it just was not happening because like we didn't have a selfie stick or, you know, whatever. And then we just started rocking. I'm like, guys, we need to, you know, go. And then finally I just like flipped out because guys, I'm going to vomit if we don't start moving the boat, you know? And it was just like, I wish I could have communicated like what was going on without just like flipping out. Right. And it's just one of those things that was kind of like, oh, I think that may have been a little more useful to like do it like this way. So
I'm about to vomit. So you need to do a time lapse.
Yeah, I'm gonna vomit on somebody. So how about that?
But I don't know because there was one part in the book where he was talking about a study that was done where people were asked to sing karaoke, and it literally reminded me of when I was at FeeCon, which is a freedom for what's it called? Freedom of
economic education.
Foundation for economic education.
Yeah. I was like, yeah. Freedom. That sounds like an act. It is. It's not the same thing. They had a conference and I was at the conference. And at the end of the conference, they had like all of these different things. So they had this big party and they had all these different things that you can go do. And one of them was karaoke. So I signed up for karaoke. And right before they called my name, or I guess they did call my name, I cannot even tell you the anxiety attack that I was about to have. So I just jumped on stage and I'm a singer. Like I'm not going to make a fool out of myself. And I know that. But I was terrified because I didn't know any of these people. And I jumped on stage and I just like, the guy was even like the karaoke. I was like, man, she's ready to go because I had to, because if I couldn't like put that nervous energy into something right then, I was going to melt down. If yeah. that makes sense. And so he was talking about that. And I was like, okay, that makes so much sense to me. There was another part where he was talking about, I don't know why I picked the guy that played Glenn from Walking Dead, but do you remember that part where he mentions him and about acting and that kind of like mindless part, mindfulness versus mindless.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a true thing that I remember from acting training is this idea that you do tons and tons and tons of homework and then you literally go on stage and forget everything and just fly by the seat of your pants. Like that's how you're supposed to do it. And so, yeah, I thought that was really interesting about like using those emotions to kind of fuel what your like maybe what is making you anxious or what is making you angry or whatever. Like Bobby, like getting to a point to where you get angry because of something, like, I think that is a, it might not feel like, because maybe other people are getting, are like, oh, he's mean. But I think it's helpful because it got the job done.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, it's kind of one of those things that's, well, I, you know, I don't get angry very often. So when I do, they kind of took it seriously. You know, it was like people that are happy generally don't receive any help because everybody thinks everything's okay. The idea that when you're like anxious or when you're angry, you focus more. So it's like more, you know, so it's like, if you have something that needs to be detail oriented, you know, they need to be detail orientated. You kind of got to be a little bit of a dick. Right. And I found that fascinating. It was like, huh. Oh, okay. And if you want to be able to tell if somebody's lying, you know, you kind of like just be sad. And then you're like better at telling if people are lying.
Happiness lowers alertness.
Yeah. And
that's
it's
the
just
part that I was just looking at right now about this study about taking the people in the room about people that were happy. I don't know, more happy, that you could raise your score by like 13% by being able to detect if you can trust someone or not. And this part about kind of being more, maybe more of a lazy thinker
with happiness.
Yeah. Cause they were talking about, I think it was a study with, like this movie ticket where they were telling people to like steal the movie ticket and then convince people that you didn't steal it. And then, so then they had people have videos of try to, you know, reacting to people and half of them stole and half of them didn't. And if they like put them in a sadder state, they were able to like tell who, you know, you become a better, you know, like the whole, like, these like these negative emotions, they like the, I like how we reframed them to be like superpowers and how they, you can, you know, as you need to go back to different things, you know, like anxious people, they solve problems before they get big, right? You know, or they can if you let them, right? And I thought that was you know, a very, I really like that approach of it. So and then like I said, the happy, it's kind of one of those things when you're like, I'm done with this, I just need to go, because you can't focus on everything all the time and you kind of just got to almost de-stress, but then it actually helps you be more creative. So that's another fascinating thing on it too. So it's like they both have their places.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought, to zoom back out, that the whole book was a really great negotiation between, like, you know, like the positive psychology movement and saying like positive psychology is the greatest thing there could possibly be, which is exactly what a positive psychology person would say. And people on the other side who would say positive psychology is like new age bullshit. This actually strikes a pretty good balance between the two and just gives, you know, continuous example. It's like, yes, don't abandon happiness. Just like, what makes you think you're entitled to it your entire life is like a really good thread through the entire book in a variety, or not even just happiness, but comfort, contentment.
I think
all these things.
To me, the most powerful part of, I guess, thread through the whole book is the idea of wholeness and
that
accepting,
accepting
both parts of yourself. Because I think the idea is that you need both of those things. And we're so conditioned to think that being anxious or angry or fearful or whatever is bad.
Right.
And it's just not true. Those are human emotions that are there for a reason. What is that one? Isn't there a book about, is it guilt or something like that, where the guy, I feel like Jake DeSillis did a podcast about it a long time ago. But basically the whole idea was, this is the one emotion that is pointless.
Guilt?
Maybe it was guilt.
Well, no, I would say shame.
Else.
I mean,
to me, well, it was shame.
Yeah.
According to the book, it was shame, right? You know, it's like the idea between, I don't know, it was one of those things where like guilt seemed to like separate it from like an action, where shame in it is like, it's, you are this, is kind of like how he was defining it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have guilt for, you know, being overweight, but you shouldn't be ashamed that you're overweight, right? And you can be guilty that, you know, you were mean to somebody, but you shouldn't be ashamed, because that doesn't necessarily mean you're a mean person, right? And so that, I mean, I don't know what book you were talking about on that, but that was the thread he was, you know, that I got from this book was, you know, one of the things was, you know, he was really anti-shame. And then, and the way he defined it, and the way that he talked about the studies, I thought was pretty interesting on that. Like with the Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, like the ones who were guilty about it, you know, but they were like laser focused on it, were like fine. But the ones that you know, weren't, they like drank like 10 times as much over like a 3 month
snowball
period.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So. And that's really, that's like one of the tough things about going to AA too, is that like a lot of people, it was like something that I saw in like two approaches. Like I went to AA a lot when I was young, and I think the court sent me there first of all. And people would talk about having these slips and they'd just be gone for months. But in later years, when I wanted to look at drinking and I did the SMART, which was more like a rational recovery based, non-religious, non-less collectivist kind of thing. And people could come with any, you know, thing they felt was like a problematic addictive behavior and share the meeting. Like that's not the way AA works. It's like,
yeah, they'll
very,
yell
very
at you.
Focused on alcohol as the antagonist. And yeah. Like, so like an NA person shouldn't speak up in an AA meeting, that kind of a thing. It's very rigid that way, but people would be like, yeah, I slipped. It was this many drinks, and I, you know, that was a bad day, and I came back. And I don't even actually, maybe in like the SMART program, people would stop even using the word slip. There was like, yeah, you know, I mean, this kind of works against what I've been doing. And there'd be some expression of guilt, but it wasn't like total devastation. It wasn't like it activated, like it just made a person drown in shame. And I think that seemed to be more commonplace in AA when people slipped. I mean, they would come in and just absolutely drowning in shame. Yeah, all of that made me relive that episode that I did with Thaddeus Russell, as I think we both kind of like reached our breaking points with each other. God Grant Me the Serenity, which was all about this. And I feel like that was his advice. Like guilt is useful and, you know, shame is just toxic. But I don't know. I mean, I would even say that once you have enough of this is a tricky negotiation too, because you have enough of a self-image and enough confidence in your ability to sort of sort through your emotions, but at the same time, you do still experience shame. I think that's like an okay situation to be in, because just like guilt is information. Like obviously no one should be living their life in perpetual guilt, because you're just getting tons of information about things that you shouldn't be doing. But I definitely think that it's useful when you're younger. Like maybe it's not helpful when you're very young and still in your formative years, because it's an easy translation to shame. You know, when you have less perspective and less wisdom, and you're told you're made to feel guilty for things, or you're told things that make you feel guilty, it leads to a kind of shameful existence. But isn't this how we like grow and learn to treat people better and learn to be more successful in our relationships, by like experiencing guilt and doing a cause and effect analysis and, you know, eliminating things like that? So yeah, I mean, I always saw guilt as more useful, more healthy, but it's not like shame. I don't like anything that is like dismiss this thing completely. It's useless. I'm very much of the belief, and this is a lot to do with internal family systems, but if something's there, it's potentially useful.
Well, yeah, I would go ahead, Nikki.
Well, in the book, his delineation seemed to be almost that shame is a permanent state of person. Like you think of yourself as a person with shame, almost as a state that you can't get out of, whereas guilt you could kind of take as a transitory thing. Like whereas the shame is just now it's part of who you are, as opposed to something you can move past. And that's the way that I interpreted what he was saying about it. Whether or not that's an accurate depiction of what those words actually mean.
I would say that makes sense. You know, for me, I went through AA too, and I always thought about going through SMART recovery, but just never did. But I will say that for the majority of the time that I've been sober, I know deep down that my sobriety is based on fear and shame, and has been for, you know, as long as it's been there. It's almost as though I'm terrified to pick up a drink, and so therefore I stay sober, which is a very unhealthy place to be, right? But I think that comes from this idea that you're talking about, Brett, where in AA it is that's basically the idea of it, is that you have to give up control to a quote unquote higher power or whatever. And it's almost like a victim mentality, and you're placed into a victim mentality, which is why I stopped going to AA, because everyone around me was constantly feeling victimized, and I no longer wanted to feel victimized. Now, I think there are a lot of things that I could have at the time, or maybe still could go through and deal with to come through on the other side and not feel shame and fear. But just being in those rooms after a point made me feel as though this was just not a place that I could actually thrive anymore.
Yeah, I think this was another one of Thad's insights, and it relates a little bit to what Nikki was saying, is that shame is kind of quicksand, right? Like, you can become ashamed of the shame and you just sink and you sink and you sink. The guilt is much more useful, but I do think that, like, back to what you said about wholeness, like, the shame is at least worth exploring. And what I would say the distinction is guilt has a direct correlation to something that you did. I mean, I think we all know this, right? Where shame is more nebulous, right? But I mean, you think about, like, when we're kids, the programs that are kind of written into us are pretty simple and hard for us to evaluate at, like, you know, 5 or 6 years old, where it's like, how are you a good person if you did a bad thing, right? You wouldn't have the wisdom to understand that good people might do bad things. And I wouldn't say, like, I think most parents, I hope most parents are good enough to, like, parse that with their kids. But that doesn't really, that's not a message I remember receiving in school, you know, or just in the whole, like, environment of school. So that's probably the biggest internalization of shame, and exacerbated by things like distrust in yourself, that can make it very hard for people, like, people to use guilt later in life, because, again, the blending, the inability to distinguish between the two. And I remember I got a lot of positive, as much as people hated that in that show we did, one thing, like, positive feedback that I got was I really appreciated the distinction between guilt and shame, because a lot of people aren't doing that. They're not, like, separating those two distinct emotions, and that one is more cause and effect and one is more useful than the other.
Yeah, I think it goes back to that whole clumping together of emotions. And I think that all of that's, to me, that's the whole point of this book, is that emotions, the different emotions will show you different things. And that's where the power comes in for yourself, right? That's where, like, if I'm feeling shame and I know that that shame, then I can therefore ask myself, why am I feeling shame? Where is this coming from? And then I can start to tease out where it's coming from and how I can move past it.
We just got the book today, and Gabrielle has been furiously thumbing through it ever since. So I'm going to let her speak for a minute.
I'm just getting to the part on harnessing mindlessness and the ideas. I kind of like the suggestions of when you have to make a choice that has a lot of options, and, like, also setting rules. I don't like the idea of setting rules, but, like, having a curbing in, like, the idea of intuition, thinking about, like, letting your intuition go and then kind of sleeping on it. And then as soon as you sleep on it, you get up, and what is your gut reaction? You're kind of having, like, a, say, quote, mindless moment, but you're going with your gut in that moment. But it's an intentional mindlessness. And then a little later, I've done this a lot, and I've wondered, boy, am I on the spectrum? I've been told that. I think it's because I sometimes have a hard time, like I've told you, Brett, even, like, when we were shopping, I said, well, I'll let you go and do your own thing, because I know if it's me looking for something, if I'm, like, in another person's way of, like, what they're looking for, sometimes it's hard for me to focus on the, like, what I perceive to be the needs of another person and making sure that we're having a good time and that their needs are being met. Do they have to go to the bathroom? Are they getting tired? Like, I don't know. I just always think of those things, but, like, I have something I want to do.
If you're hyper-focused on finding something?
Like, if I have a need to do something, I'd rather almost go by myself and have no time limits, or have my own time limits imposed so that I can immediately get out of there without having to be nice about it and just be like, okay, that's it. I don't have any time. I got to get out of here.
Oh, wait, yeah.
Because we went into this place, this really cool, like, construction salvage place called Construction Junction. And going in, I said, I need to find a table surface that's 46 by 18 inches. So that sounds like kind of a high pressure proposition. But it was a wild, fun exploration of all this, like, old, like, think about the city of Pittsburgh and all this, like, weird old construction salvage stuff just ends up. It was like an amusement park.
It was fun. And we were just there 6 weeks ago. And like I said, when you go, things will change. 6 weeks later, it seemed like 90% of the things are all different. It's a huge warehouse. So this thing on page 162 under the Teddy effect, where it talks about this doctor or this dentist and about how does he deal with his emotions when he knows he causes people pain a lot. Well, I've done this even when working with kids, I've done this. It's different when you're just in a social situation. Like, you know that that's just like you're relaxed and you're being social. But when you're like in a work situation where you have to mix information that's structured within a time limit with trying to come across as natural, I think I have to put thought into that personally. It doesn't come totally natural. So it's like, oh, hi, I'm going to be real calm. How are you? How are you? And then as soon as we like sit down, now let's get to business here. It kind of switches myself off a little. You know, I think you can integrate your emotions somewhat. But the dentist says when he greets his patients, this is interesting. This is how I have felt this exact same way. When I greet my patients, I feel human. I meet them, smile, shake their hands. We are standing on all these little details. We are standing on a soft shag carpet. Then we cross the threshold to the linoleum floor of the exam room. I change. From that point forward, I turn my emotions off. Each patient becomes a set of teeth, a problem for me to fix.
I like that a lot too. I that's something that I wish more people did in a work situation. I had this same conversation earlier, and it may be the fact that I live in the South, but oh my God, these people that you work with in the South, they want to talk about their kids and talk about their wives and talk about what they did over the weekend. And I'm like, I work 40 hours a week and 20 of it is talking to you about what you did this weekend. I have stuff to do. And why can we not just do our jobs? And I don't know, maybe it's just that I'm a bitch, but I have this problem every job that I have. I have this issue. And I'm like, why can't we just be professional while we're here? And then later, I don't care. It's fine. Well, I can talk to you for 5 minutes. I don't like small talk either, though. So maybe that's my problem.
There was this book actually on a podcast from that Manliest guy, and it was I thought I should listen to it. And it said, The Art of Small Talk, why it's important. I thought I needed to listen to that. And I think it's true. There is a real, it is a real thing that you shouldn't dismiss. But my coping mechanism, which doesn't matter how much I'll say it, I'll still keep doing it, is I tend to not talk a whole lot, like hardly at all, because I'm afraid that if I give an inch, people will start that. And I got better things to do. I mean, I don't need anyone talking to me, and I can totally talk to myself, believe me. But you know what I tell, like, there's a new kid in an intern office next to me, and like, I don't expect to even talk to him, and nothing to talk about. Okay. But I did stop by and I talked with him, you know, for a little while and asked him a few questions and welcomed. I said, well, I might seem unfriendly. Like, I never talk, but I'm totally not. And you can ask me anything. I'm right here and I'm very friendly, even though I might not seem like it.
It's really, I think it's just about having boundaries, and the boundary that I needed to set. Yeah. Which I think like 10 years ago was, all right, I just, I don't want to work around other people. Like my work, like working and serving other people has always been very social. Like, education felt like a thing where you had to, especially working with people who are basically adults. Like, it's maybe different with young kids. I worked with young kids at one point too, but like, when you're working with teenagers, to be good at that job, you have to integrate socializing into it. And I think eventually, yeah, I mean, what I learned was about how introverted I was. Like, having to perform for 6 hours a day was exhausting. And then when I went into like doing private education, and it's like 2 hours in, half an hour break, like I'm driving to the next place, that like changed my whole mood and mindset about work so much. And I went from like, really, as much as I loved the act of teaching, I was just like, at the end of a 5.5 hour day, I would be exhausted. But I could get up at like 7 o'clock on a Saturday and tutor till 11 o'clock at night. And just the difference of people moving around place to place, that was man, it's weird to remember, like, going to work.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
because,
yeah.
I mean, it's just, I wonder, it may be I noticed this too. It may be a man woman thing, because I noticed that women are much more interested in being social in the office, whereas men are not. And men aren't as offended if you're not trying to ask them every flipping thing about their life and what their family's doing and how their vacation went and blah, blah, blah. Like, oh my God, it's, and I think that it, I do agree with the introvert thing. Like, I've realized over the years that I need time alone, and I need privacy and autonomy and not being like constantly bombarded by trying to put up this perform, like, that's what it feels like. It feels like a performance,
right,
on the daily of walking in the office and, oh, I've got to say good morning to this person. Otherwise they'll wonder why I didn't say good morning to them. I've got to put an emoji in this email. Otherwise they'll say, why are you mad at me? Like, I literally worked with a girl who was like that. Like, if you didn't put emojis in your email, she would question if you were mad at her or not. What is happening?
I wonder if that, especially for women, is more, you know, like that primitive wiring or something. Like, the people you work with, you're in close proximity all the time. So maybe it's important, like, I need to, you know, unconsciously thinking I need to be able to build relationships with these people because they're nearby me. You know what I mean?
Yes.
For survival. And women more than men.
Well, most people don't choose their friends intentionally. They choose them by proximity.
Wonder where they learned that.
But I did also want to note, so thank you for solving the gender pay gap there, Carrie.
You're welcome.
Clearly, the women are friends at work, and that's where it all goes to. I got you.
Well, they don't. They do less work. I'm certain of it. I'm certain that these women that I work with do about 20% of the work that I do. Because they can't do more than that because they're too busy talking to each other.
Just back to wholeness. I remember this friend of mine that I talk to every other week, John, he's very wise, years ago, told me this. I never was able to find this. I almost texted him before the call because I was like, I could never find that thing. And this book reminded me of it. He just called it holarchy, which is basically, what is it? Say yes to it. Integrate it. The wholeness thing was like right in chapter one, where he starts giving examples of like how imposter syndrome was helpful, how quitting is helpful. Some word that he used, like it was kind of like this word for fantasizing. He calls it Zanzipped.
No.
Yeah, I kind of remember what you're talking about, how like the fantasizing about it changed like expectations and to where like it's like a road less traveled, and then like old people can do it. Something like that. So
yeah. But I mean, from there it kind of goes on into what I think is at least the preview of, for me, what is one of the more important things, like, from wholeness to remember from the book, is being emotionally agile, which is, maybe that's become like a little bit of a cliche, but again, to the question of who do you think you are to expect to be happy and comfortable 100% of your life, like, you need to be drawing from both sides, you know, positive and negative personality traits. And you really need to, without him saying it, I mean, the book is the first three pillars of self-esteem, right? It's you're conscious, you're accepting, and you're taking responsibility. And from that repeating process, you're comfortable with a mixed emotional state. Because of that, I think it gets easier to make a commitment to emotional honesty and intellectual honesty.
Well, I'm just imagining. So you say you're a person, and all of a sudden you start growing a big, long monkey tail. You're like, I don't want to have a big, long monkey tail. I'm going to ignore this big, long monkey tail and just pretend that it doesn't exist. And then all of a sudden one day you're climbing a tree and you fall out and you're like, holy shit, I wish I'd spent more time learning how to use my badass monkey tail, and it could have grabbed me and I wouldn't have broke my back falling out of this tree. But I shunned the parts of me that could have been helpful.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. That this is like one of the big takeaways that we'll, you know, go into more detail in on Monday and Tuesday. And I think all of you guys will be there. People say, I don't like this part of me. I don't like this thing. And they ignore it. They don't acknowledge it, and they don't accept it, and they certainly don't deal with it, right? Because there's this, I would think, a kind of shame around it.
I'm thinking maybe I've got some of that. I'm wondering. My husband has told me for a long time, he's like, people that are assholes are way more successful. And I'm like, I hate thinking that way because there's men on my father's side that people would deem, and I think they would too, as being successful, you know, with wealth they've accrued or legacy through entrepreneurship and things like that. And a lot of people that don't know them well would probably look at them and be like, yeah, they're kind of assholes. But I know those people and they're very charitable. Like, you wouldn't think of an asshole as somebody who gives away a lot of their money, you know, secretly, and they do. I mean, if there were someone who needed a coat, you know, they would give it to them. But they definitely are perceived as assholes. And there's a lot of people in my family that are like that because they're very just, and I say we, but I'm wondering, like, is that some hidden part of myself that I just keep being like, no, because we'll just tell everybody like it is.
Well, you know? All the women are bitches.
Well, and I'm thinking about the people in my family, Carrie, when you were saying, you know, like, you could speak to men and not have to worry so much about, like, am I going to hurt their feelings? So there's a lot of my family members that are like that. And I mean, a lot of them are men, but like, even my aunt, for instance, you know, she's that way too. I could say all kinds of things to all my family and not be worried about, you know, them getting their feelings hurt.
Yeah, it's like there's a small number of women, very small number of women.
I'm the person whose feelings would probably get hurt. Absolutely. Oh. I want everyone to like me. Oh yeah.
Well, yeah,
like,
I do too.
Not gonna have any, not gonna build any relationships with Carrie. She don't want to talk about shit.
The issue is, at least from the way that I have experienced it, is that in a business space, when you're trying to do a job and be professional, you're still looked at, sadly, I know, gender pay gap or whatever, you're still looked at as inferior and as though you're too emotional and you're whatever. So if you show emotion, you're looked at as as lower class versus a man who might get angry or whatever. If I get angry about something, I'm seen as a bitch. Yep. If I cry about something, I'm seen as too emotional. Yeah. If a man does either of those things, nothing.
Okay, now I want to step in and say that is in part because our legal system fucks all this up. You're a protected class and no man is. You always have a legal recourse against anything I say that they will never have. Yeah, 100%. You were.
Maybe, I mean, you may be true, but I don't. That I don't think is really affecting anything in my experience. I could always be like, "Oh, I'm gonna. You're discriminating against me. I'm just not that person. Like, I'm not gonna go to HR."
Maybe just for clarity, though, maybe what Nikki is saying is, like, obviously, yeah, not you, Carrie, but when Nikki said you, he's talking about women and what are the prevailing attitudes. Do a lot of women in the workplace who are millennials or our generation, have they bought into the idea that they are perpetual victims and that litigation is the, and human resources, which is at this point, because all those, you know, people from higher education that we were talking about 5 years ago, a lot of them work in human resources now, and they're encouraging this. Has that become just more legally dicey? Is that what you're saying, Nikki?
Personally, for legal reasons, I will always treat women differently in a work environment, frankly, in any environment, because of the protected class status that they have. And it will always affect the way that I have to approach those situations. Doesn't matter, like, if I know they're one of the cool ones or not, because and they can decide not to be on any given day too.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I will say it was interesting when the Me Too movement happened, like that first kind of rush of it. I was working in an area where it was just a bunch of cubicles. I was in a marketing department, and so it's a bunch of cubicles, and so lots of women of different ages. And it was really interesting to me the way, like, literally down the generations, the way that people were affected by that. So for, like, my generation and older, it was very much like, of course that goes on. Right? Like, is that news to people, like, that women are sexually harassed on a daily basis? I don't understand what the issue is. Like, we're just all used to that. Meanwhile, younger generations are like, this is the, you know, we've got to fix this and blah, blah, blah. And we're just like, grow a pair. I don't know. It was just really obvious to me that generationally there was a huge difference.
You're a big fan of CBT then. You know, learn to deal with things you don't like about life as opposed to trying to avoid them.
I mean, maybe I think it's just my personality that I'm a bitch. I'm a bitch.
Same way. I kind of feel the same way, Carrie.
But it's just kind of individualized. Like, to me, it's more individualism. Like, if a man says something to me, like, I just know that I can back myself up and for a very long time I couldn't understand why people stayed in an abusive marriage. Like, that didn't make sense to my brain, right? Until I got older and I started being able to see like the reasons why. But for my personal brain, like, that doesn't make sense that you would be offended by a man being an asshole. Have we not seen that like 50,000 times? I don't know.
Well, I also want to point out, so the reason I didn't mention the whole like legality element of it, because when Bobby was talking, Bobby mentioned that not, like, for him, even like the cool woman that he knows he can talk to, he has one of the guys, was still only a yellow light, not a green light. And that was the point that I was trying to make, is that no matter what you do and how cool she is, because of that protected class element of that relationship, that's always going to hover in there, because that is a different status for you too. That may not be something you think about all the time, but it is something that's baked into our culture. For the same reason, there's always going to be racial differences when people treat each other, because, like, say, in a work environment, there's always that, oh, well, you're discriminating against me, and you've got nothing you can do about that. So inherently, our government fucks up interpersonal relationships between human beings and doesn't allow them to be on an equal playing field.
I also think there's a flip side to this, too, about how, like, men aren't allowed to be weak either, right? Like, you know, like, if a man cries, like, I mean, like, I mean, this is something like, I mean, I've told my wife this before, but it's just like, if I'm going through like something like super depression or like really sad or whatever, I'm really not going to discuss it with her, because, you know, you can't be seen weak as with your partner. And I think that happens, you know, that's what my friends are for, right? You know, I can be weak with them. I can be at my lowest with them and be literally the worst version of myself. You know, in the work world, I know it's kind of like probably expectations on weakness, right? You know, you kind of like, there's probably, you know, societal thing that women are expected to be weaker. And, you know, so like, if it's a failing of a man, if he is weaker. And so it's one of those things where it goes, I don't know what's worse, you know, I gotta be honest. I mean, as the, to not be thought of that you could be a lead, or the one to where like you can never mess up and be awful.
I think there's a distinction between expressing feelings of weakness versus performing weakness, right? Like, I would say to her, there was a recent example that we had where it was like, I have this and this going on, and it might affect me outwardly like this. So if you see me doing this, this is what it's about. Just so it doesn't, like, we really try to like to open those little spaces and kind of see what's in there as far as like our interactions are concerned. And a lot of times things just kind of pass with like a feeling of like, something's going on. But it's almost like so small that it like, it just passes because there's like something else to do. We got to go look at a warehouse full of construction junk, and a moment just might slip by. But if I know that like, there's a state of perplexedness or a higher level of stress, which I accept and don't try to run from, I might just say, you know, okay, I got this big thing happening on Monday and Tuesday. It's obviously taking up some of my RAM right now. Like, and that's not like, all right, so all categories of me might not be functioning at 100%, which might mean like less than 100% is temporary weakness. But, you know, I'm not...
Well, I mean, like one, I'm not defining weakness as not running optimally, right? You know, so I'm talking
about, like, what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about like a car that breaks down as opposed to a car that's like sputtering or, you know, needs new tires. Right. So, I mean, you know, to torture that metaphor. Oh, interesting story. So I kind of want to like touch on what you guys talked about, because I wanted to bring it up when she brought it up with the, when she was going through the book, about your guys going, you know, going to the construction place to get, you know, whatever that thing. So me and my wife,
46 by 18 inch max, yeah, table surface.
So when we go do things, like, in general, there aren't any things that we do that we have in common, right? You know, like, we go to a playhouse, but like, whenever we go to like see which other person's family or whatever, it's kind of for the other person, right? You know, and we're kind of at a point together where we're like, we kind of do our own things and all like that. But whenever we have to do things together, what we do is we set expectations. And this came from our therapist. It was like, what are your expectations for the weekend? What are your expectations for this? So like an example of that, we go to there's a Junktique fair, vintage market days, you know, twice a year here. And when we weren't living together, we would go there and it would be very much like kind of just like a meandering type of date where we just look at the cute little trinkets, eat some food and all that. But now that like we're married, it's like, oh, I want this for the house. And so it's like, you know, that whole, like, those are like two separate purposes of going somewhere. One is to just be relaxing and whatever. And the other one is we're focused on a mission, right? And so like for us, it's important to like very delineate what the mission is when we go out together. And so that way, and then if mission changes, then we make sure, hey, I was planning on just doing this, but this has really caught my attention. I need to focus on that, you know? So it's kind of like, I mean, it's just kind of like your guys' story just reminded me of all the times like me and my wife go do something and one of us blows up, usually me, because expectations were not properly managed and discussed.
Yeah.
It's all about communicating. It's all really, like you said, like even just you kind of recognizing that feeling in you, I picked up on it just a slight bit, but you're just saying it. It didn't communicate, even if he wasn't breaking down, which he wasn't. Good for the clarification. It still could have potentially, depending on the person receiving it, could be taken as a major weakness, but he didn't frame it like that in any way. And I still don't think of it that way.
Or it's like the meme, right? Where the man, you know, the man and woman are in bed together. The dude's like having some nerdy thought and the woman, and I'm giving like the punchline in reverse order. And the woman is saying, I bet he's thinking about other women. And then it kind of like you move to the next panel over and he's asking himself some nerdy question, right? As he lays there in bed. So it's kind of like, I could very easily like feel myself getting lost and like, oh, I, you know, like earlier today when we were together and just having a good time, like, oh, I got this thing at 2:00. I got to remember that. And then, you know, Monday and Tuesday, that's a big thing. And I got to do these things tomorrow. Yeah. So just to say, hey, here's what all this that might show up as me not being my absolute best.
It's a great modeling for me, because just in me seeing you do that once or twice, I found myself communicating so much better and like being aware of my own things. Cause even just a little, if the other person notices, like you seem a little, it's at like being in bed, like I notice like a little bit of a, not a present feeling, which you're not used to when you're not living, you know, you're really making use of the time you're together. If you feel someone's not really present, I already knew that though. The good thing is I already had a feeling that it had to do with that. So, but yeah, and I love that idea about, I can see the difference between now years later where you go somewhere and it's not the same feeling. And like maybe one of the partners is looking for, you know, a plea of affection of some sort when you're walking around enjoying this kind of those day. And then the other one has more of an expectation of, let's get this done. I don't want to be hanging out here all day. I just want to get these couple things, you know. I think it's nice to talk about what your expectation might be for something.
Yeah. If there's, I don't know how much time, I mean, I got to get back into my garden, but if I could, I wanted to mention something, and this could probably end up going on a rant, but one of the things about that book that validated me was that people that maybe are more prone to depression, which I would identify with that, notice more details. And I'm like, ooh, now I've got that reason. Now I have a whatever reason for that. And I was getting kind of bored with the chapter that he was talking about anger a lot. Cause I was like, yeah, whatever, you know, I'm not sure I perceive anger as being negative. I think it's a reasonable emotion. But then I was thinking about it more. Like, I think my negative judgment about it is that, at least for myself and in seeing my son, is, and maybe it's just cause I notice it, you know, I will get swept up in my anger. You know, I feel like it's easy to get out of control. I feel like it can turn destructive quickly. And maybe it's just because I don't necessarily notice as much when I'm swept up in joy per se. And I'm trying to balance a lot. Like you were talking about kids being bad. You know, Henry says that from time to time at school, like, well, this kid's bad. And I'm like, well, you know, people aren't really good or bad. I mean, I'm trying to think, I'm like, I'm sure there's some people that, but I tend to think that there's good and bad in everyone, and try to tell him like, no, like you said, there can be good people that just do bad things. And in trying, I think when you're a parent, you're trying to give your kids maybe what you didn't get. So, you know, maybe on my husband's side, that's getting him a go-kart that's fast at 6 years old. And in mine, it's trying to be emotionally present. And it's not to say I have terrible parents. I'm not trying to be like, I'm such a victim. I'm trying to help him like move through his own anger. My son, who's 5, because he gets very swept up in it. And, you know, I can too. And I'm trying to not make it like when you're angry, that's bad. And it's a bad emotion and you shouldn't have it. But it also gets destructive with him real fast, where he's hitting, destroying property. And so like, I'm always on a regular basis trying to help facilitate. And I say facilitate because I think it is, from what I understand, scary for them to like try to be the calm wall to let those waves crash upon, which I get swept up in a shit a lot, but trying to help him be like, anger is not bad, but also like he can just be stuck, you know? And then, so how do you discern how to help him get unstuck, but not be like what you're feeling is bad or wrong, but also like you can feel angry and express it, but it can't be in a way that's going to harm someone or something.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure any of that made any sense, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot. And for emotions of my family members, who I once thought maybe were like on the spectrum, because they're pretty intelligent people. But then listening to Dan Siegel, I was thought, oh, it's not that. It's that they're emotionally detached. and most of them are men, and maybe they're emotionally detached because that's also the expectation and cultural conditioning that they need to be emotionally detached. But anger is okay. Like they can express that quite easily, you know, and I can appreciate that. So anyways, I've just been rattling around with a whole bunch of that stuff, because psychopathy is definitely a trait I could see in a lot of my family members, which sounds like really bad, but just their default isn't necessarily empathy, even though they're not unkind people. And I know that doesn't really make any sense.
I think that makes perfect sense. I think that I'm the kind of person who's very emotionally detached, and anger is my go-to almost always. I'm starting to realize, and I think this book is helping, is that anger, like there's things under that, right?
It's the iceberg emotion.
Yes, exactly. So it's like, what is underneath that? For example, I have terrible road rage. Don't ever get in a car with me. But I get so angry at people, and 9 times out of 10, it's fear, I think, is what I found is behind that, is the fear of getting in a car wreck or whatever. Fear and or feeling as though people aren't being aware, right? They're not aware of what I'm doing or whatever, that sort of thing. To me, that's just really something that this book has helped me to start to identify, is that there's a lot of, again, clumping emotions together into one thing, trying to get better at like differentiating what I'm actually feeling, which is really hard to do when you're emotionally detached.
Yeah. This is a good companion, I think, to the 6 pillars and that first pillar, that part of that book. And we did do like, I think, an hour and a half show about it too, is really, really useful to just occupying that. Then like, once you're doing that, you don't really have a choice. But like, if you make the commitment to occupy or to go into that awareness, then you have to start noticing those things, I think. And if you are also committed to like putting labels to things so they can be useful or at least not harmful, that's going to happen. So I thought the book was, I mean, it wasn't a revelation of the book, but it was definitely a novelly presented reiteration of it. So Gretchen, would you say that was your big takeaway, or your like most valuable takeaway?
What? You're good at summing things up.
Well, just the, so, and it was kind of, because like for me, the usefulness of anger or the acceptance of anger, like we get hurt in a situation, whether we're in a car, we're playing sports or whatever, when we become stiff and rigid and unaccepting of what's about to happen to us. right? Like that's when you kind of get hurt the worst. So emotionally, when it's like, oh God, anger, whether you're, you know, a parent dealing with it with a child or experiencing it yourself, just having that, we could use that phrase, emotional agility, to roll with it, facilitate it, right? You said facilitate it. Facilitating anger, whether it's in yourself or in your child.
Reinforcing it. And maybe, like, I think I've been getting better at, I think naming the emotion does help you create that space and maybe not getting swept up in it. Because I'm finding myself more often being able to say, like I said it to the lady at the doctor's office, I'm like, I'm feeling really frustrated right now. and I say that to my son, and usually that seems to help kind of diffuse, or maybe that brings me back into more presence or being grounded and not being swept up. So yeah. I think maybe there's something I'm afraid to say, I'm feeling really angry right now.
Yeah. And when somebody doesn't know how you feel, when you're dealing with a person and they don't know how you feel, they're your opponent. And if they do know how you feel, they're more like a teammate. It's not that black and white, but it's like, if they don't know how you feel, it's like, not only do I have to deal with this person while I feel like this, I also have to hide how I feel, right? Which is just basically a producer of resentment towards whoever you have to deal with. But to just like kind of pull that curtain back and go, you know, it kind of like how he says about preparing people for whatever your emotional state is. He uses anger in the book. Like, I'm feeling this might not be the best time to do this right now, and this might not come out the best way, but this is how I'm feeling, and here's what's happening. If you're dealing with a fairly compassionate person, and you might not always be, revealing that is going to improve the connection that you're having with that person.
I think so. And also helping you move through that. I guess also my hope, at least with my son, because he's the only one I can really tell anything to. You can't tell anyone anything.
Even just for your own benefit in that situation, like dealing with somebody in a doctor's office, because you can't control what their response is. They're going to be like, what kind of psycho tells a stranger how they feel, you know? But you've at least, you've kind of like turned the valve and let some steam out, I think, which is useful, and made it less oppositional. One of the things, I don't even know if I can talk through this in a coherent way, but it was one of my notes, and you actually brought it up about people who are depressed or in some other kind of negative mind state notice more details. And I really kind of questioned whether or not that was positive, where if a person is in a more depressive, which I would translate to less motivated, less inspired, looking for more details, the details might be like speed bumps and toll gates in like, get up and do something else. Get up and make a change.
Like it would be tinged with the negativity. Yeah, yeah.
Well, no, the awareness, like feeling inert keeps you stuck in a place where it's like, well, maybe I should move. Maybe I should do something. But then the details you would look for is like, well, think about this, think about that. Where if you were just like happy or optimistic or more motivated, you would just kind of like plow through those little obstacles that you might not even notice, you know?
I wonder if this book...
That was one of my thoughts about it. Because it is like, yeah, on the other hand, wholeness is noticing those things. But noticing those things is not always like helpful. In fact, you might be looking for things that are just going to allow you to maintain a suboptimal kind of status quo.
I wonder if this quote from chapter 7 would help. So it says, ruminators. So I think this is what you're maybe talking about. Ruminators can get stuck dwelling on the origins of negative thoughts and feelings. And in these cases, rumination can pull us down into the depths of pain, preventing us from doing something more fun or productive with our lives. But ruminating or obsessive thinking is very different from emotion differentiation, which is about observing and describing what is being felt or thought without getting tangled up with these mental events.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's very useful. Sorry, Bobby, were you going to say something?
Well, I was going to say about like what I was taking away from this book was kind of like how since each like emotion has like a comparative advantage, it's almost like if you're aware of it, you're like, oh, I, you know, so if you have to do like editing, like not being in the best of moods, like the best time to do some editing because you'll notice things more, right? But if you need to come up with a show idea or rights, you know, just be creative and you're in a good mood, it's like, hey, this is a great time to do that because like I have, you know, these type of things. So it's like each of these things seem to like they can, I'm just kind of worried that, like, if I remember to do something when I'm in a bad mood, will that immediately turn me into a good mood and then I lose said advantage?
You contrarian mother.
So, yeah, like that, and that is actually, that's a better example of emotional agility, is like knowing how to shift from how to, is that we talked about this on a discomfort zone once in terms of productivity. Like, it was me, Andrew, and Alex, I think. And Alex was having lots of questions about how to manage time. And, you know, Andrew was kind of, I don't know if you would stand by this today, it was a couple of years ago, but he was like, well, just plow through it and, you know, hate yourself into doing it, or something that I totally disagreed with. You know, I said, I think it's more about knowing when the time to strike is on a certain thing. And maybe that had to do less with mood and more with like energy levels. Like, what is your optimal time of day? You know, like maybe the eating the frog isn't the thing first thing in the morning. Even though, you know, that's advice that we've also talked about. But the best utilization of an emotional state is also that kind of like emotional agility that helps with actual productivity.
Yeah, it's weird because he was talking about anxiety, you know, so like if eating the frog is causing you anxiety or not eating the frog is causing you anxiety, then that may not be the most useful, you know, avoiding it may not be the most useful. It may be, that may become the dominant emotion, right? And you don't want that unless, like, because that the whole thing about the anxiety is it's letting you know about problems that you should deal with, right? Oh, hey, I'm, oh God. I mean, it's kind of like, it's, you know, like in like the pickup world, they had like the 3 second rule, right? It's you kind of just like, you send, it's like, oh, you see a girl to talk to, you just go. You don't even think about it, you just go. And so the same, I do that a lot. It's like, oh God, I don't want to do X, which is the signal, the trigger that I should just do X, right? And that's kind of like how, like, I make sure that, like, I'm always caught up on my laundry and, you know, and or do the dishes. Like, it's like, ah, like whenever I do that, that's like, okay, I need to do that. Now, I haven't done a great job with my room because I got to throw a lot of stuff away and it's really small and it's like a big project, but like small things like that, that take like anything less than 5 minutes. It's, I have like treated the whole, like, I mean, not wanting to do it, even though it's 5 minutes, it's just like, I know I'm much happier when I just take care of it. So that is one thing I have conditioned myself.
I think there's and I'm not going to give it away now, but this is definitely something that we're going to talk about on Monday and Tuesday. Like, what is the psychic payout? Cause I find myself doing that a lot too. So what's behind not wanting to do this, or what's behind not wanting to look at these certain things, or like, what is this comfort that I'm seeking through this kind of avoidance, what is it really about? And what is this good feeling that I get from doing it? And I think I found a compelling and useful way to explain it to myself and to the people who attend this thing. So it will be in there. But yeah, I'm really happy to hear you say that.
So, I mean, I have something to add on that. And then is like, so I remember from like a Jocko podcast, you know, he would take questions. And he was talking, and one of the questions was from a guy saying about, you know, I don't understand. I work really hard. I get home, I sit down, and then my wife makes the biggest deal out of the smallest things, like doing the dishes and all that. And then Jocko goes through it and he's just like, but if it's not a big deal, then you should just do it. Right. And it's always one of those things that just stuck with me, right? If it's not a big deal, then just do it. And this is all extreme ownership thing, and like it's but that's kind of like where I kind of took a lot of from that. So
I came across Jocko a couple years ago, and I forget, it's just so many things, but like I came across, I was like, oh, I remember that, and I've listened to a couple of things that he's had on there. And there's one YouTube video I really liked. It's like every excuse is a lie. I really like that one. It's like only 2 minutes, but if you ever want to share a video with anyone and give him a message, and he's just so adamant and clear about it.
Hambrick hates him, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
Hambrick hates everybody. What?
Hambrick, Hambrick does dislike. Well, I don't want to say hate. Hate's a strong word, but he's like, I remember I forget what the show Scott and I did. It was within the last year and a half or something. And he just opened talking about Jocko. And he was like, yeah, I get up at 4:30 in the morning and take a picture of it. And Scott was like, cool story, bro. Good for you. He takes a picture of himself. Jocko takes a picture of himself getting up at 4:30 every morning, right?
It's actually when he finishes workout.
Oh.
So it's like, so at the end of the workout, he like takes the photo. So it's.
Yeah, that's probably a better idea, because I'd just be like, ching, and then back to sleep.
So,
yeah.
I thought one of the other things, I think it was that book that mentioned that I thought that's really interesting, was saying that we are bad judges at predicting how happy or unhappy something is going to make us.
Yes.
In this book, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Well, he talked about how the what your idea and something that you want to have versus something that you would actually like when you have it, they're like different parts of the brain. So like that was one of the things like in the book that I was like, just like, wow.
Yeah. You're like basically lying to yourself all the time about like, I mean, it's as simple as like, oh, well, if I buy this house, it's going to be awesome and everything. And then you buy the house. And then after a month, now you have a house and it doesn't matter anymore.
Well, like, again, this is, so we'll deal with this next Tuesday for those of you who will be there. Right. It's like, what do you actually want to have? Right. But then like if you're not deliberate enough in choosing those wants, what are the properties of having that thing that once you have, you're going to go, man, wasn't that other grass greener? You know, I think that's a really important consideration that a lot of people don't do. Is it, and that's like, I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying it's been a formula for ultimate success, but there's lots of things that I've thought about doing and then said, well, here's 10, like, well, that would feel good to achieve. Here's 10 things that I wouldn't want to deal with once achieving it, you know? And that is something that honestly, I'm still trying to find a way through, because like you could create a story like that for anything that's hard and not do it.
You can talk yourself out of everything.
Right,
believe me,
right,
I do it.
Right. So then I think a lot of it has to do, it is kind of a CBT thing, but Nathan and I talked about this a lot, like about disputing those beliefs, right? You can get real meta with this where it's like, okay, well, these are the things I want. And maybe you make better decisions about what those things are if you're honest about the things that come with it that you don't think you'll like or you don't want to deal with. There's lots of people who are more successful in like doing the kind of like, maybe they don't, I mean, nobody does exactly what I do and I don't do, and nobody does exactly what they do, but we do similar things and they have far more success. And there's a lot of those people that I wouldn't trade places with for a variety of reasons, right? But that doesn't mean that I'm happy with where I am, you know, at the same time. So then it's kind of like drilling down into like, well, okay, well, here's 9 things that I don't want if I did get this want. What is it about? What's the underlying belief in each one of those things? Or what's the self-defeating belief in each one of those things? You can dig for sure.
That's some duality, I think, about dissatisfaction, right? In some ways, people are like, oh, that's so bad. Like, you're just never satisfied. But if you are satisfied, what else do you do with life? Mm.
What do they call it? It has a name where you just basically meditate on the worst case.
Fear setting. And like the death stuff is the memento mori. Was thinking, yep. About, you know, thinking about death.
I'm just trying to be more aware of my external and internal discomforts, and maybe my bias towards maybe comfort.
Yeah,
which seems to be a reoccurring theme in books, or just like our own Sunday conversations, or anything. But
yeah, I would agree with that. That's one of the things I thought was really cool about this book, was talking about, you know, getting out of your comfort zone and how staying in it is so detrimental. It's just so easy to be there and stay there.
Until it isn't, in some cases.
True. Yeah. I mean, it always comes back around to bite you, I think.
And it just ends there. Anybody else? Nikki still here?
There was parts that I kind of disagreed with some of the stuff, but by and large, I mean, it's pretty sound advice to just pay attention to yourself and learn to know yourself as good as you can.
Yeah, I'm skimming my notes real quick just to see if I have anything else, but I'm inspired Discomfort Week. When I started reading this book, I was like, oh man, I wish more people had heard some of these conversations that we've had.
Well, here's a quote.
Yeah.
If you want to end with this quote.
Sure.
At the same time, let pleasure loom large in everyday life. Enjoy the sensory, social, and intellectual delights available to you, as long as there is no mismatch with your deepest values. Instead of succumbing to what you ought to be, allow yourself to become whole and live well.
That's beautiful.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
All right. So we can leave it there today. Do we want to talk about what's next for next month?
Influence.
Influence. We want, so we want to agree to influence.
I always called it indecision, which is not the right name.
There's probably a book called Indecision out there.
There too. Probably is. I used to have a book called The Procrastinator's Handbook that sat on my shelf for forever, and I never opened it, and I always thought that was hilarious.
There's nothing in it. It's a joke.
It may be. I don't know.
Thanks for coming, everybody, and thanks for the great conversation. I love the book club, and thank you, Carrie, so much for setting this up and for making sure it happens every month.
You are very welcome.
Lazy yellow moon coming up tonight, shining through the trees. Crickets are singing and lightning bugs are floating on the breeze. Baby, get ready. Across the field where the creek turns back by the old stumble road. I'm gonna take you to a special place that nobody knows. Baby, get ready. Ooh, ooh. You and me going fishing in the dark, lying on our backs and counting the stars where the cool grass grows. Down by the river in the full moonlight, we'll be falling in love in the middle of the night, just moving slow. Almost over and the summer's coming, the days are getting